Oil prices, home sales, and a little Christmas tinsel. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl this December 24th, Christmas Eve. Thanks so much for being with us. We start today with our weekly wrap, a look back at the big business news of the week. And I know this is usually a Friday sort of thing, but we wanted to give our guests a holiday off. We're joined this Thursday by Felix Salmon of Fusion and Cardiff Garcia of the blog FT Alphaville. Hey guys, thanks for being with us.
Merry Christmas.
Hey, Adrian.
Hey. So, Cardiff, I want to ask you about the new home sale numbers we saw this week. They were up, but less than some analysts expected. What's going on there?
Look, I'm not that worried about the housing market. It's kind of been buffeted by conflicting forces for the last few years. On the one hand, it's still kind of hard to get a mortgage without good credit, and there's places where there's a lot of restrictions on what you can build. On the other hand, so long as job growth continues and people keep making a little bit more money as they have this year, I think we're going to see the same thing next year that we saw this year. Slow, incremental growth, but an improvement nonetheless.
Felix, what about you? We also saw some gloomy existing home sale numbers. Are you as
Those
optimistic?
Those are the important ones.
Yeah?
Like the amount of new homes is tiny compared to the amount of existing homes which get sold. And I think what's happening is that people just aren't selling their homes. It's not so much that people aren't buying them, but you know they're a little bit more expensive. I mean, prices have gone up, so they're more expensive. And people see the prices going up. They're quite happy where they are. They have a job. They don't need to move for a new job or anything like that. And so naturally, the turnover goes down. It's not in and of itself a bad thing. It's just a decent market.
Should we be fixated on these right now or not a big deal?
Well, I mean, the new home sales people care about because it's a sign of the health of the construction industry. But existing home sales, I think they'll, you know, it's not so important, really.
All right, let's move to oil prices, which were trading up a little today, but still at $38 a barrel. Felix, why haven't these low oil prices done more to boost the global economy this year?
Because, a lot of the weakness in the global economy is from oil exporters. You know, it's Brazil, it's Russia, it's countries which have just been, you know, seeing big problems. And when you have this collapse that we've seen in the oil price, that has repercussions. Now, you're absolutely right that in the grand scheme of things, cheap oil means cheap energy for everyone, and that's probably good for the global economy. But there's definitely winners and losers, and it's hard for all of that to play out. It takes a while.
And Cardiff, pull out your crystal ball for us. Where do you think oil prices are headed next year?
Oh, God, I don't know. But I can say this, that even if they rebound quite a bit, the resilience of low oil prices is still probably the biggest geopolitical story of the last year and a half or so. And keep in mind that even though, yes, this is going to be a problem for the banks that lend into the energy sector and for the energy sector itself, this is still a big break for the middle class. And the middle class hasn't had that many breaks in the last few years. So I think overall, agree with Felix. I think this is a good thing. And eventually you will see that feed through into the economy.
Although I'll come out and answer your question and say that it is very easy to see once a certain amount of pain has happened, once a bunch of, you know, wells have gone dry or closed up because they're just not profitable anymore. I can easily imagine oil prices just skyrocketing kind of overnight when you least expect them
really?
To.
Cardiff, you think that can happen?
I don't think so, partly because the fracking industry has completely changed everything. In other words, the ability of the industry to react to higher prices is way different from anything we've seen in a while. And also, the sort of approach that Saudi Arabia and some of the OPEC countries have taken is also dramatically different. So I think they can definitely come back, but I wouldn't worry too much about like a massive spike.
All right, before we go, I want to talk about shopping really quickly. We've got numbers that show we're all doing a lot more shopping online than at stores. And I wonder, Felix, if that affects the economy. Does it matter how we shop or just that we're shopping?
Well, it affects shopping malls. But if you ask me, the fewer shopping malls we have, the better. I can't stand shopping malls. What we're seeing, I think, is that people thought that online shopping would be a big thing for many, many years. It never really was. And now, pretty much for the first year, it's phones. People have suddenly realized how easy it is to pick up their phone, press a couple of buttons, and then something just arrives at your doorstep.
It's like magic.
And they never did that with their computers, but they're doing it with their phones, and it's transforming the retail industry.
Yeah. Yeah, in keeping with the spirit of Christmas cheer, I think this is a good thing. These are innovations that make our lives a little easier and a little bit more convenient. And so, again, in the short run, you know, you're going to have to build up the infrastructure to accommodate and to catch up with what people want. But this is a great story. This is something that I hope does continue.
Felix Salmon of Fusion and Cardiff Garcia of the blog FT Alphaville. Have a great holiday, guys. Thanks.
You too, Adrian.
Thanks, Adrian. Take care.
Wall Street didn't have a whole lot of cheer today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The NBA is holding its traditional Christmas Day games tomorrow. There are something like five of them, but there's going to be something a little different this year. The league is running ads showing players speaking out against gun violence alongside victims of gun violence. And this isn't an individual player tweeting an image or supporting a cause. This has the whole NBA's name on it, which, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, is mighty valuable.
This is part of one of the ads airing tomorrow.
My parents used to always say a bullet doesn't have a name on it.
Someone put a bullet in the back of my 14-year-old son's head.
The gun should never be an option.
Every Town for Gun Safety is the former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg-funded group behind the ad campaign. Jason Rzepka is the director for cultural engagement.
It's a tremendous platform to be able to present this issue to the country in human terms, not in political terms.
He says the idea to go to the NBA was actually Spike Lee's. Michael Leeds is a professor of economics at Temple University.
I think it was a brilliant idea. The NBA occupies a unique piece of real estate in American culture right now.
Between the players and the fans, it intersects with a huge array of different demographics, which means in advertising terms, it's a unicorn. Paul Swinand is an equity analyst at Morningstar.
Because media has become so fragmented, advertisers, marketers, brands are looking for something that will unify a big audience and also can connect with them emotionally.
The audience for the ABC Christmas games last year jumped 16% from the year before. And this isn't just an NBA thing.
So the power of sports and the power of sports branding is actually rising.
At the same time, players like LeBron James or Derrick Rose have become more outspoken on social issues, which may be influencing the NBA's brand itself. Paul Swangard is a lecturer at the University of Oregon.
It's a continuation of what the NBA believes is part of their brand equity.
If fans buy into that, Swangard says, then the ads actually strengthen the NBA's bond with its fan base. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The minimum wage in California is going up to $10 an hour in January, but some cities around the state have already raised their own minimum wages even higher. And that boost has had a pretty dramatic unintended consequence. Turns out the rate hike affects toddlers and subsidized child care. Deepa Fernandez from KPCC in Los Angeles explains.
Thank you for coming to Domino's Pizza. Can I help you? I speak Elena.
Alerna's Naga Kapiro really likes her pizza delivery job in Oakland, where she works about 30 hours a week.
You want a medium pizza to top? What kind of medium pizza?
She's done all sorts of jobs that pay about $10 an hour since coming from Havana 10 years ago.
Pepperoni, pineapple ham.
So when Oakland raised its minimum wage earlier this year to $12.25 an hour, how did she feel?
Oh, me? So happy. But not just me. Everyone felt happy, like, wow.
Kapiro started making about $63 more each week. That helps with the rising rent costs in Oakland and all her other expenses. But the single mother was hit with another monthly bill that she never expected. Her new wage now pushed her marginally over the threshold to qualify for free childcare for her toddler. This little bundle of personality, Aileen Giselle, who's two. In California, if someone's income gets to a certain level, they have to start paying some of the childcare costs. Kapiro now has to pay $42 a month for care that used to be free. With her raise, that puts her about $200 ahead. Still pretty good, right?
The problem is that there are months that I might come up short.
A $42 monthly childcare fee might not seem like much, but Kapira says living in Oakland is getting more expensive by the day.
See, when my wage went up, everything went up. All my food costs, and it was really my child's expenses that went up. The rent went up, everything went up.
Instead of us being happy because they got increase in their hourly rate, we do understand that also gives them hardship to pay those family fees.
Mira Jurek manages the benefits program for an organization called the Four C's of Alameda County. It helps parents like Kapiro obtain the monthly childcare subsidy. She's seen many mothers struggle after getting the minimum wage raise because of new childcare costs.
And it could look to average person that $42 is nothing compared to their raise, but it's a lot to them.
LA is also raising the minimum wage over 3 years. Michelle Sartell runs programs in the LA City Office of Childcare. She says, imagine a family where both parents work for less than $9 an hour.
Then their salary rate goes from $9 to $10 to $10.50 an hour.
Which might sound good, but
they'll be dropped from the rolls.
Meaning the child will be ineligible for state-subsidized childcare or preschool altogether. So what will these parents do? The cost of private childcare in California is comparable to the cost of community college, far out of reach of minimum wage earners.
It means that they're going to have to figure out other childcare arrangements.
But then I can hear all those critics out there saying, see, minimum wage raise, not a good thing.
I don't think that's what we're saying. I think what we're saying is that we need to raise the income cap, otherwise they cannot afford to pay for childcare.
Any change to that income cap would have to come from the state. Alerna Kapiro still pays the childcare fee. She hires her mother, Ethelvina Kapiro, to babysit her two-year-old. A state program pays Ethelvina a nominal amount for that care. So why does grandma do it? She says she does it because it's her granddaughter. And what does Ethelvina do all day with her grandchild? Well, we're Cuban, she says, so we dance. In Oakland, I'm Deepa Fernandez for Marketplace.
At Christmas time, Santa, or at least helpers dressed like Santa, are everywhere. In malls, at parties, on street corners, and sometimes in a courtroom in New York City. Marketplace's Claire Tennisgetter brings us a story of Dana Friedman.
There are a lot of retirees who play Santa. I see the difference is they play Santa. I am Santa. My non-Santa name is Dana Friedman. I am a trial attorney. I practiced mostly in the Manhattan courts, and after 9/11, we were looking for a way to give back to the first responders. So my paralegal, she said, well, you're fat enough. Why don't you get a Santa suit? And we've been doing it ever since. I'm Jewish. I went to Santa school, and even the gentleman who ran the school, he called my office. He said, he does know it's his, you know, Christmas. My secretary was like, yes. He goes, but he's Jewish, isn't he? And yes, he's aware, knows what he's doing. Being Santa is expensive. My suits range now $500, $600 per suit. But once you have your accessories and suits and what have you, it can be anywhere from $250 to $350 an hour. One time I had to appear in court in the evening. It was an emergency call, and I came into the court in the Santa suit. And the judge just said, are you an attorney? I said, yes, because I figured you probably were. Why? No, I don't want to know. Are you here to try a case? And we did, and we won. Nobody wants to try a case against Santa Claus.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree. For me, been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Coming up,
I think it has tapped into a sense of nostalgia where people today, with all the bells and the whistles and everything is so glittery, we're still looking for the traditions.
The secret behind tinsel's sustaining shimmer. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets closed early today, and not on much of a high note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 50 points, a 0.25%, to close at 17,552. The Nasdaq added 2 points, less than a 0.1%, to finish at 50.48. And the S&P 500 lost 3 points, 0.1%, to close at 20.60. So where did retailers land on Christmas Eve? JCPenney dressed down 1.9%. Kohl's lost 0.5%. Macy's was off 1.6%. In the holiday spirit of dancing sugar plums and all, a look at a few purveyors of sugary treats. Swiss chocolatier Lindt sweetened 1.5%. Swiss food giant Nestle, also known for its confections, served up 2.75%. U.S. chocolate maker Hershey's stayed about the same. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.24%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Christmas is a shiny, sparkly time of year, in part thanks to that centuries-old decoration, tinsel. Now, those shimmering garlands are, for some, an eyesore, but there are fans out there who love nothing more than the look of a tinsel-trimmed tree. As part of our series, Holidays Brought to You By, Bobby Allen from WHYY in Philadelphia has a look at our changing relationship with Christmas tinsel.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
The U.S. birthplace of tinsel is in South Philadelphia. The company Bright Star has manufactured the thin, sparkly stuff for three generations now. Judy Kinnerman and her son run the company. Her late husband, Sandy, was known as the Tinsel King.
For many, many years, when my husband was very involved in the factory, he would come home and the tinsel icicles would be hanging from his shoes, and he'd bring them into the house all the time, every day.
Those Christmas lights that look like icicles you see hanging from porches everywhere? The family has a patent on that, too. But the original wispy stuff is still their number one seller. Kinderman says Bright Star still controls 80% of the market.
I think it has tapped into a sense of nostalgia where people today, with all the bells and the whistles and everything is so glittery, we're still looking for the traditions.
Tinsel was invented hundreds of years ago in Germany. Back then, it was a luxury good made of real silver. In modern times, the delicate strands were made of lead until the government declared it a potential hazard to children. Now, it's made of shiny PVC sheets like this. Sourced from China. But some still covet the old school version.
Of course, we still have customers who come in to this day and ask for the lead tinsels because they were beautiful on the trees and they hung very, very delicately. But that has changed.
Les Gould is the guy to talk to about how the tinsel market has evolved. He runs Orman Incorporated that sells holiday decorations to 1,500 independent retailers around the country. And tinsel sales have declined.
I would say at peak... And to where we are today, our business in that is probably about 10% of what it used to be.
What's taking tinsel's place? High-tech decorations like LED reindeer and...
These laser light things are very popular right now.
He's talking about these little devices that shoot an array of green and red laser stars that you can project on your yard. He says they're especially hot in the suburbs. Kathy Decato of New Jersey passed by the tinsel while out holiday shopping recently. She thinks tinsel's kind of cheap-looking.
I like ornaments, lots and lots of ornaments. I like bows and ribbon around the tree rather than having tinsel and garland. Yeah, it reminds me of when I was a kid, which is nice, but I don't want to see it now.
Bright Star's Kinderman isn't too worried, though. She says the company makes enough tinsel every year to string it around the entire globe and still have a little left over. They're still shipping thousands of feet of tinsel every year. And increasingly, there's a growing market among web consumers.
It's kind of sparkly and shiny and a little bit different. You know, obviously, draping yourself in tinsel would be a little odd.
Angela Davis of Dallas, Texas, just put the finishing touches on a red tinsel purse she's selling on Etsy. And she's also offering a gold fuzzy tinsel scarf.
When you mix it with other things in the blend, I think that kind of maybe brings it to a little bit nicer of a level.
Elsewhere on the craft site, you'll find green Christmas tinsel dresses, tinsel top drink stirrers, and of course, knitted hedgehogs made out of tinsel yarn. But to any crafters looking to add to the pages and pages of tinsel oddities found on Etsy, beware. Craig says tinsel has its sharp edges and can nick you as you weave. In Philadelphia, I'm Bobby Allen for Marketplace.
Most of us make purchases every day, and most of the time there's not much to it, not much to think about. But every now and then, the simple exchange of goods and services can lead to something surprising, even life-changing. A while back, we began asking for stories like this from you, our listeners. We call the series The Transaction. And today, on Christmas Eve, we bring you a story about a ball of yarn and a special gift.
My name is Sarah Kathleen Henry, and I live in Phoenix, Arizona. This transaction is about purchasing yarn for a blanket at a craft store in March of 2012. My mother, Becky, was diagnosed with primary peritoneal cancer in January of 2012, and it was terminal. The doctors told us that she would maybe have 2 years to live. I visited Phoenix shortly thereafter to see her and my father, and we were sitting around one afternoon talking about all of the blankets that she had crocheted for family members and friends who'd had babies. She would likely pass away before I ever had any children of my own, and it was important to her that she make me at least one blanket for any babies that I might have after her death. She asked if I would go to the craft store with her while I was out there. We drove together to the craft store. A couple days later, stood in the aisles for probably an hour, feeling for the softest yarn, and we picked one out in a light ivory. On my next visit, a few months later, we were sitting in the living room, and she brought out a box with the first corner of the blanket crocheted. It was beautiful. That was the last time we ever talked about the blanket. She got so sick that I didn't want to bring it up because I didn't want to put any pressure on her to finish it. But unfortunately, things got worse, and not just for my mother. In February of 2013, so just 13 months later, my father was diagnosed with terminal colon cancer. And in the 2 years that followed, the only thing that we really could think about was living each day one at a time and doing the best that we could to manage the reality of the situation. My mother passed away on July 29th, 2014. Not even 6 months later, my father passed away, leaving both my brother and I in our early 30s without our parents. I spent a good amount of time at their house trying to figure out what to keep and what to give away. I stumbled upon a gift box, a sweater-sized gift box in their closet. Opened the lid and peeled back a layer of tissue paper. And there in front of me was the ivory baby blanket with scalloped edges. I had no idea that she had finished it, and it was there, completely perfect, exactly as we had planned it. The moment will be with me forever, the moment of finding the blanket. And the blanket itself is that there's no dollar amount you could put on that blanket.
Marketplace listener Sarah Kathleen Henry in Phoenix. The series is all about your stories. So go to marketplace.org/transaction and tell us yours. This final note before we go today. My mailwoman, Rosie, was on my street delivering packages last night at 8 o'clock and back again this morning at 6:30. The USPS says it's likely going to deliver 500 million packages this holiday. UPS is going to drop off another 630 million. It's reportedly using rented U-Hauls as delivery trucks in some markets. FedEx says it's going to deliver some packages tomorrow that have been delayed by storms. We give all sorts of shout-outs on the show to people who keep our economy humming along. And today, we thought we'd say thanks to the modern-day Santas out there, all the Rosies of the world, scrambling to make sure everyone's gifts arrive in time to be wrapped and put under the tree. Today, the Dow dipped 50 points, 0.25%. The Nasdaq added 2 points, less than 0.1%. And the S&P 500 lost 3 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Dupke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.